I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. We're continuing our special series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits, talking with people who have been on the inside of a financial crisis. Today's story takes us back to the last time there was such a crisis with U.S. banks. In the late 1980s, the savings and loan scandal blew up, revealing the fact that real estate developers and other investors had been using these kinds of banks like personal ATMs, making risky and highly leveraged real estate deals with money that most people thought was tucked away in a savings account. At that time, Diane Buchness was a bank examiner whose job it was to pick apart these shady deals. She says some of what she saw made her sick to her stomach.
Greed is a very fascinating and complex phenomena that I don't believe people realize that they're into it until they're too far into it.
Diane says what amazes her is that the same lack of oversight which led to the savings and loan crisis 20 years ago is once again what led to the troubles we're experiencing today.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
The savings and loan crisis cost a lot of people their life savings. And the bailouts back then cost taxpayers over $120 billion. Diane Buchness saw it all firsthand. At the time, she was a senior bank examiner. It was her job to go inside those savings and loan institutions, sort through the papers, and see how those companies got into trouble. We'll look at one case in particular, that of Charles H. Keating, Jr. Even today, Keating is a symbol of the excess of those times. He was accused of mismanaging hundreds of millions of dollars. He was convicted of fraud and sent to jail. Diane Buchness was assigned to the team looking into Keating's finances, even though they all knew there was more to Keating than just balance sheets.
Charlie had quite a reputation. He had people in high places that were power people. I mean, he had Mother Teresa come up and bless Lincoln Savings and Loan on a couple of occasions. He had Alan Greenspan write a paper about the fact that Phoenix was going to be the next Vegas.
In the 1980s, Keating was heading up a Phoenix development company which bought its own bank called Lincoln Savings and Loan. Keating was persuading his depositors to turn their savings into junk bonds so he could finance his opulent hotel and spa called the Phoenician. Diane Buchness was asked to look at the books, though she had yet to meet Keating himself.
One day, the examiner in charge came and said, well, we're going to do a property inspection of the Phoenician. Would you like to come? And I said, sure. And so we went, and there was this tall man, very charismatic personality, tan, you know, infectious smile, and it turned out to be Charlie. And so he took us through the Phoenician and told us about its 9 restaurants and its golf course and its haciendas and, you know, this and that. And the pool had inlaid mother of pearl. All of the marble was imported, and it was just like this phenomenal resort. So I kept looking at it. I kept asking him questions like, you know, why do you use, you know, imported marble when you can, you know, use stuff in the U.S.? And why are you using mother of pearl? Isn't that going to be hard to clean and all this stuff?
Was he a little bit perturbed by your questions?
Well, I think he was. I mean, no one else. I think everybody was so in awe with him, or they just didn't think that they should be asking these questions. But it would have taken years to cash flow the amount of expenditures that he was putting into that hotel. Why was he doing such extravagant expenses when, in fact, Phoenix had yet to become a tourist destination? You know, I just was asking just common questions. You know, why are you inlaying this pool? It was beautiful, don't get me wrong. But, you know, it's like, how can you spend this much time putting individual pieces of tile for a pool? And so,
what did he say? What was his explanation?
Well, he just said he wanted the best. He really believed that this project was going to be the premier hotel in Phoenix. But the problem with Keating was, basically, Charlie was using depositors' money to fund his real estate development. And in my mind, that is not the way that you use depositors' money.
And help me just understand one thing, Diane. At the time you're a senior examiner, it's your job to go there and make sure that if the guy is using money from his bank's depositors, he's not frittering it away. Is that right?
Correct.
And as an examiner, Diane, would you make the connection between the sort of opulence of what you were seeing and the fact that you knew a lot of the money was coming from just regular, ordinary people who'd put their money in as a deposit?
Yeah, that's what made me upset. I mean, that's what really just made me very angry that he could do that. And then come to find out, he had actually convinced many, many senior citizens to move their deposits into junk bonds. And so when it did fail, there were many, many, many people that were with nothing. And that's, again, shows the charismatic personality that he had.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story and our special series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits. At the height of the SNL crisis, Diane Buchsness was examining loans at Charles Keating's bank.
And so I actually used to look at each loan as if it was a puzzle. You know, you needed to have certain things to fit the puzzle. You needed to have the purpose tied to the source repayment, looking at the appraisal. I mean, you needed to tie everything together and see if it made sense. And if it didn't make sense, well, then you would ask questions and then determine if it was going to be reasonably profitable or reasonably going to cash flow or if it really needed to have some reserve set against it. And, you know, we had a lot of checks and balances. We had examiners in charge that reviewed our work. If we had concerns, we would talk to other examiners. And then, of course, we had a regulatory book that was like 4,000 pages long. Of course, I had been a banker before, and I had given commercial and residential loans. So when you sit down and talk to the lending officer, and if they really, you know, sound like they know what they're doing and they're sincere and that they can tell you about the project, well, then you also have another piece of the puzzle that adds to it. So to me, it was fascinating because every loan was a different story to tell.
And what's interesting to me at this point is it sounds like what you were doing back then, this looking at each loan like a puzzle, is precisely what's going to be happening at banks right across the country with this financial bailout. As everybody, you know, as each little mortgage has to be examined and classified and all the loans and the banks that are going under and others are also being examined.
Well, you're correct. It's a little bit too late, though. I mean, I guess the concern that I have and which is I wrote my congresswoman about is that where were the regulators years ago when all of this was happening? Where were the internal auditors? Where were the external auditors? I mean, in my mind, I just cannot believe that suddenly a bank that is huge is bankrupt and they have to be sold overnight. And it's like, where were the regulators during these last 10 years, 8 years, 5 mm-hmm. years? Where were they and what were they looking at? I guess I'm just so confused. I don't know. I haven't looked at the regulations lately. I don't know if there are any regulations. It sounds like there aren't, but I just cannot believe how things could have gotten so bad. And now that they are this way, you are very correct. They're going to have to look at those loans. In fact, I think they're doing that right now with a lot of these foreclosures, residential foreclosures. They're trying to keep people in their houses. So they're trying to restructure everything. But I'm just in shock at what has happened. I would have thought that the regulators would have learned from the 1980s, and it looks like they didn't.
Diane Buchsness says at the time when she was picking apart the excesses of the 80s, she concluded there was a lot that regulators seemed to have overlooked. Diane and her team were looking into the financial affairs of one real estate developer, Charles Keating.
It had been going on for like 3 or 4 months, and I came into it like late in the game, like 2 months into it. And at that point in time, it was an interesting exam because we were not told to talk to one another, nor were we allowed to talk directly to the loan officers. We were supposed to funnel everything through our examiners in charge. But in my mind, the whole issue of doing a good job is collaboration among examiners. Like I should be able to talk to the people doing direct investments, or I should be able to talk to the people doing risk management. The team that I used to work for in Portland, Oregon, we were like a SWAT team. We were really good experienced examiners. And we always talked with one another and we discussed how things should be done and all that. But this particular exam, we didn't have that much collaboration or discussion about the exam other than maybe over drinks in the evening.
Do you think that might have something to do with the high political sensitivity of this particular case you were looking at?
Yes, I believe that wholeheartedly.
How long were you on this case, Diane? Do you remember?
I think I was on about 2 months, if I'm not mistaken. You know, it's like 20 years ago, so I can't. They all blur together, but I think I was there about 2 months.
The Lincoln Savings and Loan Company wound up, I think, being one of the biggest bailouts of that time. When you finished, did you have any sense of satisfaction that you'd at least contributed to a better understanding of what had been going on below the surface?
Well, sure. Yeah, I did. In my mind, it's unfortunate that Mr. Keating or Charlie was maybe perhaps ahead of his time. The flip side of that was so many investors lost so much money, and it's unfortunate that rather than use individual investors to help him build that hotel, he utilized depositors' money. And I think there was a joke back then that the best way for a real estate developer to become famous was to buy a bank.
Sounds that there's a little part of you, Diane, that kind of, maybe it's too strong a word, but admires his chutzpah, the, you know, the, what he was trying to do there.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I mean, I thought he was very charismatic, and I thought he had done a lot of good because he had a long history of stuff going on before he got involved with Lincoln Savings and Loan, because he gave me his book to read.
Just in case you needed
just
some
in case I didn't know enough about him. Yeah, I know. But there's a right and there's a wrong. And I truly believe that even though he had these ideas, he was going about them the wrong way.
Diane Buchness was a senior bank examiner during the time of the savings and loan crisis. I'll talk more with her in just a moment about her line-by-line examination of corporate greed and what it teaches us about today's troubles. This is part of our series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. Today, we're continuing our series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits, a chance to better understand this financial crisis through the people who lived and worked through other such events. In the 1980s, Diane Buchness was a bank examiner. Her work took her inside the savings and loan crisis. That financial crisis led the headlines just like this one does today. Billions of dollars were lost. Diane was assigned to the one SNL case that became a symbol of the crisis, the Lincoln Savings and Loan case, and the man who was in charge of it, Charles Keating.
In a Los Angeles federal court today, former financier Charles Keating Jr. sentenced to 12 and a half years in prison for swindling small investors in a savings and loan scandal of epic proportions.
Do you remember hearing the verdict that he was going to do jail time?
I do remember hearing it, but in my mind, I had met many, many other developers that should have been in the same boat with him that didn't get, you know, sentenced. So he was used as an example, and I'm sure there's others that went to jail too, but there are also many, many people that did not, and that's unfortunate.
Diane, the work that you do as an examiner is very practical and very specific, but I wonder what you learn about human nature when you get, you know, your hands into something like the savings and loans mess in the same way that examiners are going to be looking at what we have today. What do you learn about human nature when you get elbow in on those things?
Well, it's fascinating to me because I also have a psychology degree. I really wanted to be a psychiatrist, but I got this scholarship, so I went into banking. But greed is a very fascinating and complex phenomena that I don't believe people realize that they're into it until they're too far into it. I think the idea of power coupled with greed is extremely dangerous. The whole keeping up with the Joneses, or I want to be the best real estate developer in the world, or I want to have my name plastered on every building in New York. I mean, stuff like that does not impress me because there's certain people that probably had to be stepped on in order for that person to be where they are today. And as an example, in this particular savings and loan crisis, once these institutions are bought, they mark to market the assets. They try to lower that mark to market as much as possible so that when they sell them, they have these huge profits and it makes them look like they are doing great from a profitability standpoint, which then pumps up the stock and they get more investors. And it's just a cycle of the rich do get richer. And I think that you'll find in this particular crisis situation today, that same thought will transpire.
Are you saying that all of us are vulnerable to the temptation of this kind of greed that you've seen?
No, or else I would be greedy.
And you're not?
I don't think I am. I live within my means. Like I said, I think it becomes like a, I think it slowly creeps up on some people. I mean, it's like when you have the dessert, if you want to eat the whole dessert and not parts of it or something. It's a very difficult thing to define, but I don't believe that everyone has that embedded chip in them that says I'm going to be greedy. I certainly don't. I mean, yeah. I may be jealous now and then, but I'm not greedy.
Diane Buxness has worked in all aspects of banking. In the early 90s, she went to Lithuania. It was a time when that country was trying to reestablish its independence after years as part of the Soviet Union. She helped the Lithuanians design a banking system. After years of seeing much of what went wrong with U.S. banks, this was a chance to do it right, to start with a clean slate. I wanted to know what she learned.
In a country like Lithuania, they still have your separate banking system, you know, stock market. It's still a pretty simplistic model. And we did a really good job in defining and developing a safe and sound regulatory system. We did have to close some banks. And Lithuania is doing really well today. But you can't really compare, you know, a country that gained independence like in 1990 and just starting out all over again to our country that has been through so much and is so more complex.
But is it your experience that it's easier to run a country fairly, easier to run banks that are fair when the banks are separate from the investment banks and they're separate from the insurance companies rather than having them all under one roof?
I truly believe that. I mean, I remember back in the 80s, or early 90s when we were talking about this, it came to the point that we're going to have like a super regulator or someone or some group that becomes, you know, the whole puzzle. You can't just do this piece or that piece or this piece or that piece because obviously right now in this financial crisis, we have figured out that that did not work.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to create this super regulatory body that can really review the entire complexities and look at the risk and look at all of the components of both the banking, the investments, and the insurance.
And Diane, you saw firsthand how bad things can get by being as directly involved in the savings and loan mess as you were. Does that mean that you set up your own finances to protect yourself from what we're going through right now, or are you feeling this along with the rest of us?
I actually had a nest egg that turned into a fried egg right now because I did not sell just because I did not want to create a panic, but it's unfortunate because I have lost a tremendous amount of money. I just look at it from the standpoint I am young and I think things will come back and I'm not panicking. But yeah, I got caught up in it and my husband works for Washington Mutual and I mean, he's caught up in it big time. So
yeah, is he going to be able to keep his job or do you know yet?
Right now, no one really knows what's going on. I mean, he was one of those number crunchers that does all of the interest rate risk management and all of the modeling and all of that geeky stuff that, you know, human calculators do, which he is.
Well, I mean, in the case of Washington Mutual, it also is a savings and loan. Did they make the same mistakes in the past few years that companies like Lincoln Savings and Loan made 25 years ago? Did we learn nothing?
My question is, where was the system of checks and balances? Where were the people, the internal and external regulators, 3, 4, 5 years ago? So it's just kind of a big question we all have. I mean, we can't really give you good answers because we don't really know ourselves, but in my mind, how can you lead up to a bankruptcy and not know it? You know, it's like suddenly the lights were turned off on that Thursday, and how could that have happened? How could that have happened?
Yeah.
You know, millions of shareholders have nothing now, and people that used to work for the bank, their retirement, they have nothing. I just cannot understand how you can suddenly have a bank that is a pillar of the Pacific Northwest that has been around for 119 years suddenly have it go collapse, like being sold overnight.
And what does it mean for the two of you? Are you looking at going back to work? Is your husband looking for work elsewhere now?
Well, yeah, I'm probably going to maybe go back to work. We haven't really discussed that. He is looking into jobs in New York, which would mean, you know, we would move. But yeah, we'll take it as it comes.
Can I ask you one more thing, Diane? And that is, when you called Washington Mutual a pillar of the Pacific Northwest, and I wanted to pick up on that because it seems to me one of the results of what we're watching today is that a lot of the smaller banks, Wachovia here in North Carolina, a lot of these small, and they're not small, but they're regionally based banks, are going under. Are you thinking we might get to a point when there's just like three banks and that's it? That's the only choice we have?
The concern I have is, in fact, we will have these huge mega banks, but then what's going to happen when one of these mega banks that have maybe 10% or 15% of the entire deposit base of the United States fail? What's going to happen then? What's going to happen next?
Diane Buchsness worked as a senior bank examiner during the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s. She joined me from a studio in Seattle. Coming up next, a story that shifts us back into the financial crisis that we're in the middle of right now. In recent years, it seems anyone with a pulse could get a mortgage. But that's changed. It's hard to get money these days. The billions in bailout money that the banks were given just yesterday will take a long time to filter down through the system. Alice Evans isn't sure she can wait. Now, you might remember Alice. We first met her in July. Hers was a tough story. She was just days away from opening a new cafe in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, when the late spring floodwaters arrived. Her kitchen was downtown. It was also underwater. Alice told me this past summer how she tried to save everything, anything, from her business.
I ran downstairs and just started shoving papers and, you know, everything I could get. And we kind of had a brigade going, and I was handing bags out, and people were hauling them upstairs. And I tried to grab the computer that we basically had our recipes on. Well, by the time I got that out, the waters had breached up to where our building was. You could see the current, and it was, you know, every time you'd look, it'd be a little closer, a little closer. And there was probably 2 to 3 inches of water in there already.
This is in your kitchen?
In my kitchen, yeah. And my beautiful, brand-new, year-old kitchen. And again, I don't know if it's denial or what, but I kept thinking, okay, it's not going to be that bad.
But you're in the basement. I mean, if it's up to street level, there must have been a part of you thinking this whole area could fill up.
Well, I think it was a lot of denial and just wishful thinking.
I don't want to go too far into the finances here, Alice, but I mean, this business had been open just over a year. I'm sure all this stuff wasn't paid for yet, right?
Absolutely not.
It wasn't insured because you couldn't get flood insurance because you're on the floodplain. So now you owe money on stuff that's in some landfill somewhere.
Yep.
I mean, how can you even imagine the notion of starting all over again? How do you get the wherewithal to say, okay, we can do this?
Therein, again, lies the rub. People are like, oh, well, FEMA's here. Well, FEMA doesn't deal with business. FEMA is residential only.
Right.
Then the next option is SBA.
Small
business. Well, they'll give you a loan.
Yeah.
It's like you
said, I've already got one of those.
Exactly. I'm all good with the loans, thanks. And then I found out that my business partner has decided that she doesn't want to do this anymore.
What, did you guys have a meeting or something?
No, I got a voicemail.
Oh, dear.
That's one of those bad breakup stories.
What did she tell you? What did the message say?
She just said, Alice, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. Give me a call.
And have you spoken to Cheryl since?
I have. Yeah. I have. And I absolutely and completely understand where she's coming from. I mean, I really, really do. But that's the other thing that lets me know that this is what I'm meant to do. I mean, after everything that we've been through this past year, the heartache, the struggle, the juggling, the, you know, getting all the different colored envelopes from, you know, the people you owe money to, and being able to finally get to that point. Like I said, we were a week away from opening our cafe, which would have just increased our business exponentially.
Yeah.
I still want to do it. It's in me. It's who I am. And I'm not sure how I'm going to do it yet, but I do know that I'm going to do it.
Alice Evans is still trying to determine the future of her small business. The shock of the disaster is worn off, but when I caught up with her this week, she told me that financially things are really rough now.
I'm getting close to my wit's end. I'm trying to keep a positive attitude. I'm trying to look towards the future, but it's every day that passes, it gets bleaker and bleaker.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. The problem for Alice Evans is not the customers. It's the money she needs to purchase new equipment and rebuild. She says that in downtown Cedar Rapids, well, the customers are there and things are on the upswing.
It's remarkable. Much of the debris and, you know, all the garbage has been removed. There's still, you can still see the great big huge dumpsters out front. A lot of construction vehicles, you know, with the people trying to help us rebuild. The stench is pretty much gone because before it was, I mean, you could be driving in your car and if you had your windows rolled down, it was just enough to make you gag. Huh. But that's pretty much gone and it's coming back.
Can you see a water line on the building or have they scrubbed all that off?
For the most part, it's been scrubbed. I mean, you can still see a lot of garbage out on the curb. I was driving the other day and it just brought tears to my eyes because there was a big stuffed bunny that was all, and pardon me, I'm getting ready to get emotional. You know, you could see kids' toys and stuff out in this great big garbage pile, people sitting on the stoops, just looking, you know, very dejected.
Now, how about restaurants downtown? Are any of those open yet?
We have a few that have come back. There was one place that came back recently. They do burritos and, you know, sandwiches, lunch kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they came back, which was a huge deal. And I think there's another sandwich shop. But for the most part, there's not a whole lot of places downtown to eat.
Now, these places that are opening up, are they busy?
Oh, gosh. Oh, yeah. There's not a lot of places down there. And so you go where food's available. And I get calls every day and emails, you know, are you guys back in? We've got a lunch I need to cater. You know, are you guys open? We need to do this. We need to do that.
Now, you're making it sound like you're back in business, are you?
Kind of, sort of, but not really.
All right, let's take it one piece at a time. That facility that you had in downtown Cedar Rapids, the one where all your equipment was, where you lost all that food, what does that look like today? What's going on
it's
there?
It's still gutted. The landlord hasn't yet been able to get to our building to start rebuilding. He owns quite a number of properties downtown. So we haven't begun rebuilding our facility downtown.
So when you're cooking, where are you doing this work?
The Cedar Rapids Chamber of Commerce created a program called Adopt a Business. Fortunately, and it was just a blessing from God, we were adopted by a local business called Frontier Products. And they have a kitchen facility that they use for their employees. And they have graciously allowed me to use their kitchen when I need to.
So it's a commercial kitchen. It's a place where you can cook the food for resale.
It is, but there are a lot of obstacles. I mean, it's 20-something miles away, and they're a working kitchen, so it's hard to coordinate, and you know, I can't.
I guess you don't have freezer space, and you can't sort of go in and cook for whoever, whenever you want. You've got to I understand.
And part of the other problem too is because I don't have a place to store things, I'm buying everything retail, which increases my cost dramatically. And so I have to really be careful about what jobs I accept and what jobs I don't accept.
And the jobs she accepts, of course, have everything to do with how much money Alice Evans can gather together. In our series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits, we'll hear about Alice's current struggle to get financing. That's next. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This week on the program, we're featuring a special series called Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits. I'm talking with the people who have been through and people who are going through financial crises. Alice Evans is living proof that what happens on Wall Street eventually finds its way to Main Street. Alice was running a small catering business in downtown Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was wiped out by a flood earlier this year. Then Alice's business partner left her. Now she's stuck trying to start up again at a time when Alice already has a lot of debt. Well, her business is called My Personal Chef, though these days it likely feels more to her like My Personal Nightmare.
We lost, just in equipment, we lost over $150,000. We had taken out about $40,000 in loans to open up the cafe. We had payroll. We had, you know, other bills that were coming up. So we had probably, all in total, we probably had close to $200,000 to $250,000 that, you know, we lost.
And the equipment that you lost, did you own that or did you owe money on that as well?
We actually own that equipment. My former business partner had a restaurant prior to us opening My Personal Chef. And so we had much of the equipment, the pizza ovens, you know, the dishwasher, things like that.
And last time we talked, your former partner had left you a voicemail, I think, saying, "I'm done. I'm out of the business." What's happening there now?
You know, it's difficult for me because I'm trying to think of the right words to say because I don't want to misrepresent. But it's hard for me to talk to her now. You know, it's her
she's,
life. Is
she's
gone
not
on.
Back in. She's not part of the business. She's done.
She's done. And you know, I'm still struggling. I had to do everything afterwards, trying to get what little money we did get. You know, that all fell to my shoulders, juggling the bills, doing all of that stuff. And, you know, when you want to call and you're all cheery because your life has gone on, you know, frankly, I'm not in the mood and I don't want to hear it. And so it's hard for me.
And the fact that the two of you split up, is that making it harder for you to get My Personal Chef back up and running again?
Well, I can't get SBA money.
That's Small Business Administration, right?
That's the Small Business Administration, and that's who, for disasters, FEMA doesn't deal with businesses.
Yeah.
So it's the SBA.
Why do they care if it's one of you or two of you?
Well, a couple of reasons. Number one, at the time of the disaster, we were a business entity as the corporation, and they need her information on the forms to be able to do the application. Secondly, just off of my information, they're saying that I can't repay a loan. Remember, I haven't had an income for 2 years. I have, you know, I'm struggling myself.
When you go to the bank, Alice, and say, I'd like a loan, and they say no, are you really surprised? I mean, when they look at, you know, would you loan money to you?
And no, on paper, I look at it and I say, wow, this is not cool. But I did it before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did it before.
That's my question. So how do you turn the corner now?
That's what I sit up at night wondering. That's one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is how do I do it? How do I do it?
Have you tried to go to a bank?
Yes.
Tell me what happened.
They said no, but they did it with a smile. So.
Do you think that this, Alice, is just part of the fact that banks aren't giving money to anybody these days, or did it have to do with your particular circumstances?
I think it's a little bit of both. My problem is, though, it's not like, you know, I'm asking for a handout. It's not like, you know, I ran my business into the ground with bad business practices and I need money. I need a bailout. I didn't ask for this.
Now, if it was a bailout, maybe we could arrange something.
And that's what I was, you know, if I had stolen or blown millions of dollars, you know, then I'd be all good. And that's the frustrating part because everybody gives lip service. I was listening to the news the other day and, oh, small business is the backbone and small business is integral to this and that and the other. But when it comes right down to it, if you don't have money, you can't get money.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to a special series this week on The Story, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits. It's our chance to look over the shoulders of people who are in or who have been through financial crises. Alice Evans is a Cedar Rapids caterer who's trying to get back on her feet. After trying the Small Business Administration and having no luck at all getting a bank loan, Alice turned to the Chamber of Commerce, where she did get a special kind of grant for someone in her position.
They did get that. Unfortunately, it was $20,000. And when I say unfortunately, that's really a misnomer because I was so blessed and so grateful to get that. But in the grand scheme of things, $20,000 isn't a lot of money.
What happened to the money then?
Well, I've got it sitting, waiting. I've had to tap into a little bit of it, like I said, because we had bills before. I had payroll. I had different things that I needed to take care of. So I had to tap into some of it, but I've got it sitting in a bank, hoping that I can add to it and get things moving again.
Weren't there some recent announcements about grant money also being made available from some other source?
The Jumpstart program that's through the state. However,
it sounds like you're gathering yourself.
I am, because I've been dealing with this for months now, and I am so incredibly frustrated. In order to get the Jumpstart money, you have to have been approved for either an SBA or a bank loan.
Hang on. Now, the Jumpstart people were willing to give you how much money?
We didn't even get that far as specifics. I asked for $50,000.
And did they say, yeah,
they called me. The lady called me and she said, Alice, we need to schedule a time so you can come in and bring the documentation so we can get this check to you for this money. And of course, I'm just elated, you know, and she's going through the documents I need to bring in. And now, mind you, on the application, I had put that I had gotten the $20,000 from the chamber money, thinking, you know. They asked if I had gotten any money, and I told them. And she says, well, you'll need to bring in the loan papers. And I said, you know, what loan papers are you talking about? Oh, well, you know, in order to get this grant, you have to have gotten a loan. And I said, well, I got the chamber money. Oh, well, this has to come from the SBA or a bank. And I said, what? And then she proceeded to tell me that I didn't qualify.
Someone's willing to give you money, but someone else is not even willing to lend you money.
Yep.
Where's the logic in that?
If I knew that, I could regrow my hair. I could get rid of my ulcers. I could probably sleep at night. I don't understand it.
Alice Evans ran a small catering firm in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, one that was wiped out by the flood earlier this year. Alice will tell you she has a lot of resilience, but even resilience can only go so far when it's so difficult for a battered small business to get the financing that it needs.
I'm getting close to my wit's end. I'm trying to keep a positive attitude. I'm trying to look towards the future, but it's every day that passes, it gets bleaker and bleaker. You know, not playing any cards, but I'm a targeted small business, you know. I am supposed to be that one that if anybody needs help, you know, it's not like I've got hundreds and hundreds of employees. It's not like I've been in business for years and have money in the bank. It's not like, you know, I'm struggling. And if I don't figure something out soon, then, I mean, I've gotten to the point where I'm looking for a different location, seeing if we can get a smaller location, you know.
You mean a downtown place, right?
I'm looking for anything right now. But unless I can find some place that's already set up for a kitchen, I'm looking at huge expenses.
And while all these questions are going round and round in your head, are you being asked to pay money on the loans that you have outstanding?
Absolutely.
And where's that money coming from?
We got a small amount from insurance. I mean, we got $10,000 based on that. That was for the equipment. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to keep all the balls in the air and pay what I can when I can. And the other thing that's just ramming a stake through my heart is we're coming into a catering season. I mean, with the holidays coming up, this is like tax time for, you know, an accountant's for us. So it's just a very frustrating situation.
Alice, why does it matter so much to you to make this work? I mean, why not? You could probably get an office job. You could probably, you know, go to a temp agency and you know, make the money to get by and you know, put it off for a year or two. Why push so hard at this?
Because this is what I do. This is who and what I am. And I was blessed with the opportunity to do it. And we were doing well. People enjoyed what we had to offer. And, you know, if push comes to shove, that's absolutely what I'm going to do. I will go get an office job. I'll be miserable doing it.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I told you this when we talked before, but you know, when I was in corporate America, after I got off of work, I didn't go home building databases. You know, I didn't go home creating Excel spreadsheets. I cook from the time I get up in the morning at work, and then, you know, I would go home and cook. I love doing it. I love doing this.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. For Alice Evans, running My Personal Chef is more than a love affair with cooking. Finding some way to get her catering business back up and running has become a matter of faith.
As long as there is a sliver of hope that I can get my business going again, then I have to hold true to that. And I will walk through hell with gasoline underwear on to make it happen. This is not something that I entered into lightly. And I absolutely understand that business is a risky proposition. It's not for everybody. And one of the things that my mom used to always tell me is no guts, no blue chips.
And even when your personal finances are going to just pay off the interest on those loans, even when you're thinking about selling your house to get the money to try and get the business back, I admire your drive, your dedication, your determination. I it seems like there's a lot stacked against you. You know what I mean?
Dick, I'm a black female that grew up in Iowa. I've always had a lot stacked against me. And if I let having things stacked against me stop me, I would never have accomplished any of the things that I've accomplished. I raised a male child by myself as a single parent who graduated from high school with academic honors, who prepaid his college education with a scholarship, who has made me the proudest person I could ever even begin to imagine. If I let adversity or if I let big obstacles stop me, I would have never done anything in my life. And the other thing that keeps me going too is I'm not alone in this. There are hundreds of small businesses in the same situation that I'm in.
And we are hearing that right now. We're hearing that from the Obama campaign. We're hearing it from the McCain campaign. Are you paying any attention to that?
You have no idea how much and that's where the frustration comes in. And it's like, okay, then put your money where your mouth is. And here's the thing. Small business can include anybody from 2 employees to 100 employees. You know, if you're making, you know, you have to be making less than $1 million a year. Okay. You know, before the floods hit, I had 8 employees, you know. They've all had to go out and find other jobs, you know. And I know some of them are still on unemployment because they can't find jobs. And it's just, you know, the employees that I've had, you know, they were earning an income. We were paying taxes. You know, we were doing our part.
So do you set yourself targets, Alice? Do you say, okay, by the new year, my personal chef is going to be back up in business, or?
One of the targets that I had, I thought we would have the kitchen by now. That didn't work. Okay, so I'll start looking for a new kitchen. You know, I contacted my realtor. I said, this is what I'm looking for. I haven't heard back on that yet, but I'm not unrealistic about things. I understand that I am facing a serious challenge. I understand that there are hurdles ahead of me that, and right in front of me, that are huge. I get that. But I also know that if you want something bad enough, you got to fight for it. And I'm not done fighting yet.
Alice Evans lives in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. So where do you fit into our list here of bankers, brokers, bandits, or business people? If you're also someone who finds themselves squeezed in this crunch for credit, if your own business can't get the money that it needs or that it used to get to operate, let me know. You can contact me through our website at thestory.org or call me at 1-888-966-9862. Tomorrow we'll continue our series, Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits, with the trader, Chris Stewart. Chris has a firm that trades on the Chicago Exchange. He says he's never seen anything like what he's going through right now. And his is a stressful job. But Chris has a novel way of relieving that stress. He goes up to drummers at live performances and dares them that he can drum better than them. Well, one bet paid off. Chris got to play with his idol, Dave Mason. The catch was this. Chris had to join the band on stage at a huge outdoor concert in front of thousands of fans.
So it comes time to put the stuff on the stage and get loaded in. So as I'm bringing my stuff up, tour manager's bringing my kungas and bongos up, and he said, no, I don't want them over there. I want them right by the keyboard player where everybody can see them. And now I'm really nervous, right? Now I'm dying. I had never really played in front of that many people before, and I didn't really know these guys that well. I was so pumped up as I got out there and we started the first song. I took a huge, deep breath and said, no one ever gets a chance to do this. Just enjoy it for what it is. Yeah. And I kind of settled right into it and from never looked back.
Chris Stewart on Tough Trading and Good Rhythm. That's tomorrow on our series Bankers, Brokers, and Bandits. If you have your own submission to our list there, I'd like to hear from you. You can send me a note. Care of the Story, 120 Friday Center Drive, Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The zip code is 27517. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Have a Stratocaster in that color. Don't you get too lost in all I say.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.